If you haven't already, explore the many ways to connect with our show. Watch full uncut conversations on YouTube, gain AIA-approved continuing education credits through Arcademy, and make sure to check us out and follow us on social media at Detailed Podcast. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
You know, architects are trained to often look for simplicity or look for clarity or look for singularity. And I think a project like this really forced myself and our whole team, and there was a great team that I could, you know, we worked with on this, that multiplicity had to be part of the solution, partially because you had things adjacent to each other that wanted to be together but weren't necessarily going to function in the same manner and or needed very different criteria to do their jobs well, and that those two things could exist and coexist being as different as they were.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, senior specification writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guest today is Kent Sorbier, FAIA Lead AP, and principal at Bolin Sawinski Jackson, with offices in Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, San Francisco, Seattle, and Wilkes-Barre. Kent's approach to design values evocative environments that maintain a thoughtful sensitivity to the natural environment and the communities they serve. Kent's work ranges from centers for engineering and wellness, corporate headquarters, and university laboratories, to civic facilities and museums. The core theme to this diverse experience is his commitment to crafting spaces that consistently define new paradigms, as has been the case on projects ranging from Carnegie Mellon's new Highmark Center for Health, Wellness, and Athletics to the Frick Environmental Center. The project we're talking about today is, you guessed it, Carnegie Mellon University Highmark Center for Health, Wellness, and Athletics in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. The Highmark Center for Health, Wellness, and Athletics at Carnegie Mellon University reimagines how student support can be brought together in a single, cohesive environment. The inception of this project was marked by a multi-tiered plan to bring student wellness to the forefront of campus life.
This project was planned by the university for some time, really almost 15 years, where they were studying and master planning how to bring more holistic and comprehensive approach to kind of student wellness on campus. And in the end, they instituted a series of projects, and this is the kind of capstone, the final piece of the puzzle for them. And so it then had to have a very specific location, which comes to some of the site issues of it being a constricted site. But then it also meant that there were very specific programmatic elements that they wanted to bring together, which gives it, you know, that name that just like rolls out, you know, so easy to say, because it's, they combined health, wellness, mental health, and athletics, and said, and spirituality, and said, we're going to bring all this and put it in one building under one roof, is kind of the way they approached it. And Carnegie Mellon and the folks who championed this project and were starting it had been tracking some incredible data because it's a data-driven school, and we're looking at the increase in visits, whether it was for health and different types of health, but then also really diving deep on the expansion of counseling within their school and realizing that this was something that the stigmas were going away and that was being embraced and that they needed to meet the students where they were in a way that had not been done before. And to their credit, they really, that became a big driver and a big piece of the project.
The design process and team assembly largely took place online as a result of the pandemic, a story we've heard a lot lately. Despite the unconventional approach to projects at the time, the team managed to smoothly align project goals and collaborate cohesively.
We had started the RFP process, the request for proposal process, in early 2020, and we had scheduled the interviews for mid-April of 2020.
This is Bob Reppe, university architect at Carnegie Mellon University.
Of course, at the time when we scheduled them, they were to be in-person interviews, and of course, that all went out the window. So we did not just the selection of the design team, ultimately, of course, BCJ with Kent and his team, but also the entire design and permitting process of the building was done remotely. This is a building that we had a few in-person meetings that were outside in those dark days of 2020 and early 2021, where we would meet in the warmer weather outside, everybody'd be masked to do kind of understanding of blocking and stacking of the building. But the vast majority of the project was designed online. And I think to great success. As uncomfortable as it was really positive process, and we ended up with an incredible building out of it. And I think BCJ and Kent and his team really should be commended for how they worked through that could have been a debilitating kind of set of circumstances for a design process. They ended up making that work. They were able to integrate some new software mural boards and things like that, which really became a big deal in those early days of the pandemic to reach out and to be able to utilize the components of their team that were not based in Pittsburgh. Actually, in many ways, they were able to kind of pivot very quickly and be able to include their folks from their Philly office, as well as their West Coast offices, who would have normally had to travel to Pittsburgh under the previous way we did design. They would have traveled to Pittsburgh and been here for workshops and such. Instead, we were able to pivot and do it all remotely and save time of travel and expenses and things like that, to be able to have them work with groups. The other thing that they did is in that pivot, besides bringing their folks together, they were able to more kind of specifically focus and get into a kind of more nuanced discussions with the individuals in the building. So one-on-one Zooms were much easier to kind of organize because everybody was at home. The other component of it was where they were able to coordinate individual work sessions across the board with all the various functions. There's a lot of different actors in this building. The one part I think that was difficult about the process was the kind of open forum to get campus participation. So they were able to pivot very well to get individual participation or groups, specific groups that are going to be in the building. But one of the things we really try to do here at Carnegie Mellon is embed campus in the design process for our major campus buildings. And that was really difficult to do with everybody kind of phoning in. One of the town hall meetings we had on the project, half the people had their cameras off. So I don't know if they were actually listening, that kind of thing. So as many ways that they were able to make some positives out of the tough situation, there were some negatives that we just weren't able to overcome.
By uniting physical fitness, mental health services, and wellness resources under one roof, the new facility reflects a holistic approach to student life while carefully balancing openness, privacy, and acoustic control across its diverse programs.
So this one had two very distinct kind of issues. And one was programmatically driven, where you're bringing together counseling, student health services, a spiritual center, a wellness center. But then you also have NCAA athletics and training and recreation center. And these things all have they have interrelated needs and desires, but they also have very different criteria, you know, they behave very differently. Some of these spaces need to be very private and quiet, and some need to be very public and loud. And sort of bringing those things together into one space is a, was, became a kind of interesting programmatic puzzle. Related to the planning then too was just like all good universities, there was more program than space on the site. This site was important because it connects the center of their campus to a nearby wooded park. So for this program, that was a really important kind of location for them. But there's not really enough room. And we were limited in terms of height because of the historic context with the gymnasium. And basically there was a master plan mandate to stay below the peak of the gymnasium roof. So we have to, everything that we build is lower than that. And we can only go into the ground so far because we're on a rock ledge. So the solution really, you know, that materialized was to make a very broad building that works really up to all the margins and then hollow it out in the center. And so the creation of this kind of cloister and the wellness garden in the center of the building seems like kind of a curious element, but it actually was the key that really unlocked how to put it all together.
With a design scope that encompasses bridging two independent structures, one of which is historic, the permitting process required clear communication and cooperation.
One of the things that I would emphasize is we approach it not as a adversarial kind of challenge. We realize, look, we're trying to solve a problem. They're here to help solve that problem. And if we can work kind of arm and, you know, more together than in any adversarial way, there's much more to be gained. And so, you know, starting from the planning level here, like I said, we were working, you know, we hit the margins on every setback. And then we had two areas where we knew we needed to go beyond that, right? There was real benefit to move into those, some of those setbacks. And so working with the planners and the city zoning department, we were able to get administrative adjustments for those and basically, you know, administrator variances for those couple items. The building's actually permitted as two independent structures. So this was also an approach because of the historic gym, right? The gym was exposed steel, very large building, and we wanted to keep it that way. We didn't want to add into mess and paint or essentially cover up some of the structure of that building. So we ended up with a design strategy kind of late in schematic to turn the building into two independent structures with two construction types. That carries all the way through the design. So, and that requires sitting down with the permitting folks to make sure that they see it the same way we see it. And that our strategies, you know, are sound and our approach is legit. So in this case, these buildings are not on the registry. They are tracked within the kind of original campus. And then they have a kind of, there's a more of a scholar history to them in terms of folks who manage them, maintain them, have documented their history very well, but they are not on the state or the national registry. But the building, it was kind of an interesting cyclical process where that original gym was completed in 1924. It was one of the last buildings that was a part of the original campus from 1905. And then we were in 2024 completing the kind of expansion and addition of it. So,
set on a challenging sloped site at the edge of campus, the building carefully works within tight height limits while preserving part of the historic Skibo Gymnasium.
The historic building is to the south. It also had a series of mature trees, and that south edge is also where the project connects to a wooded park that's called Schenley Park. That's one of the city, you know, the original Pittsburgh had it. Pittsburgh actually has a kind of lovely collection of urban wooded parks kind of woven through it, a little bit like Portland, I think, in that matter. And the north edge of the site is very much kind of in the heart of the old campus. And so the building has a very different character along that edge. It's very rectilinear. That's where we really embraced the kind of the buff, what's referred to as the Katanning brick, which is from the original campus. It's kind of buff, light-colored brick that's ubiquitous throughout the original space. But then we had this challenge of the topography and how to kind of move up along the west edge of this site. And that required, you know, we had 26 feet of, you know, topography to kind of traverse along that site and to try to do it in a way that then left a building that was also, looking to be universally accessible. And so, you know, that led to these kind of long ramps, sloped sidewalk entrances, and this kind of scissor of movement along the west. The landscape, this was also a site that was very prone to flooding at the kind of curve and hill that was collecting a lot of water coming out of the park. And so the historic, you know, previously this site was very prone to a pattern of flooding. And so we were challenged to then kind of manage all that. And the water strategy for the site really drove the site design. It manages 100% of the water on site now, which was, you know, a challenge, but also made an incredible opportunity where basically all the landscape is doing work for you. All the site walls are weirs that are holding water, that are slowing water down and managing it, and, you know, kind of treating it as it moves kind of across from this high point to the lower corners.
Underneath the salvaged wood flooring of the Skibo Gymnasium, the foundation, or lack thereof, revealed the surprise.
We were not fortunate in that we were designing this project literally during the pandemic. And so we didn't have as much physical access to some things that we may have otherwise wanted or needed. But that also then pushed us to pivot into things like doing a full LiDAR point scan of the existing building to try to understand, you know, what it is. But that tells you what you can see still. And so until you start digging in, you know, there's definitely some surprises. And the couple that were, I think, at most front of mind were the floor. You know, as we started to pull up the old wood gym floor, which that's one of the pieces we ended up salvaging and using throughout the new building. But underneath it, you know, we weren't quite sure what we would find underneath it. And it had been set on, I mean, it's kind of ingenious. It had been set on, you know, hand-cut end grain wood blocks that were used to level what is a really, you know, incomplete concrete slab underneath it, you know, which wasn't exactly what was expected. And that meant we had to do some additional remediation to get that level, get that, you know, suitable to become a kind of base for the new turf and the field house. And then we were also planning to do, there's some pits jump, you know, for high jump and long jump pits that are in this training facility as well. And we had to go through that slab. And so then what we find underneath was always a bit of a surprise. And then we're looking at, you know, blindside waterproofing strategies and things like that for these new sand pits within that structure. And that's also when we were wrapping around the one side of the gym with a new gym, which is the one, you know, kind of that sits along Tech with the kind of with the terracotta facade on it. But the inside of that gym was, we were leaving the exterior facade of the historic gym. And as we started digging down, that's really when we realized exactly what we were dealing with the rock, because we ended up exposing this whole section of ledge and understanding that there was no foundation underneath. And we were now looking at the side of the rock ledge, which in the end we ended up leaving, which was a kind of fun twist in the project. That wasn't our original intent, but at one point we were doing a tour with some of the leadership from the university, and they saw that and asked, "What is that?" Well, that's the rock that the building that the university was built on like 100 years ago. And they're like, "Perfect. We need to leave that. How do we do that? So then we had to figure out how to waterproof and treat that in a manner that it could stay where it was. So
can you actually see it?
You can. You can't actually see the rock. You can see the profile of the rock now. I wish you could see the actual rock.
At its core, a landscaped wellness garden serves as both a visual and spatial anchor. It introduces daylight deep into the building, creates a buffer between active and quiet zones, and offers a restorative outdoor space for reflection.
It began early in the design, really, as a way to create a kind of quiet center for the whole project. And so I'll often describe it even as a cloistered space, right? It's a space that you move up into through the building. You can only see the sky when you're in this space. You don't see any of the other buildings. You don't see any of campus. You don't see anything else. It has a very different materiality to it. We did end up using a brick in there, but it's a terracotta brick that takes the palette from some of the Gustavina tile that's used throughout some of the other interiors on campus. And so it's this lovely sort of light, earthy clay blend that just has a, you know, kind of natural feel to it. And it's a very simple space. There's nothing fancy about the space. It's really, you know, this kind of trying to make something that has really just a few materials in it. The landscape became a big component of it and is really developed as a sensory, like a full sensory kind of garden. So things that have certain smells, things that have kind of make a specific sound when the wind blows. It's intended to kind of engage people in ways beyond just what they see. And it's also very much intended to be a contemplative space. So while it's this big space in the middle of the building, it's really a series of pathways. There's no big gathering space. Nobody's having a departmental party or anything out in the space. This is a place to walk, to sit, to meditate, to kind of take a pause. And it connects then to two levels of the building. It also then does some really pragmatic things like bringing air and daylight into all of the health clinics and all the counseling suites, right? Because it's right between the athletics and the counseling. And that really, in the end, is one of its big roles, is it's actually this outdoor space that buffers between, you know, what's a 2,000-seat arena to a counseling suite.
So it's open air. It's not like covered like by skylights or.
It is. Yeah, it's open. It's open air. We thought about, you know, should it be a winter garden, because Pittsburgh, like Portland, is rainy, but we just leaned into the natural elements.
With two differing foundations under the two separate structures, the exterior design necessitated a unification element to bring them together.
The idea in the end is that it needs to look and behave like one facility, one place. But from the kind of technical permitting side, we were separating them so that we could leave one entirely unprotected, right? And leave the steel, you know, it's sprinklered, but we weren't fireproofing the steel. The other building is much larger, fully fire, you know, all the steel is protected. But they share a boundary kind of between the two. And that boundary, what we ended up doing is taking a strategy there structurally, because as I was speaking to the, you know, one is sitting on rock, one is now sitting on proper foundations. We anticipated that they're going to move differently. So we left a significant kind of movement joint between the two. But then we really wanted to disguise that. We didn't want to telegraph that necessarily to the world. And so the terracotta rain screens that wrap up the west facade in particular kind of cut across over that. And the joint is, you know, really disguised deeply within one of the bends. And you'd have to know which one and know where it is to even find it. You know, but that was a way to kind of have it both ways, where we could treat it as two structures, but have it appear as one unique thing. There are two large fire shutters that are tucked away kind of up in, you know, spaces you can't really see, that allow the building to be perceived very much as one space and a contiguous thing, but, you know, allow it to then separate in the case, you know, as, when it needs to.
The exterior draws from the language of nearby buildings, translating their material logic into a contemporary expression. Light-toned brick defines the campus edge with a calm, grounded presence, while a glazed terracotta rain screen and fritted glass introduce texture and movement.
There's an approach to the building in that, you know, that north edge that's kind of on the campus edge is brick, but it is also still a contemporary building and a contemporary structure. It's really, the university has a design philosophy that they refer to as the Simons Principles. And what that really challenges their designers to do is to think about the place, the history of the place, but to create buildings that are inherently contemporary within that place. And so this is a building that attempts to do that, where we're looking at ways to use brick that nods to some of the original Hornbostel patterning and bonding patterns that he was using, but to use them in a new way and to create our own new bonding pattern that develops his and expands them and sort of takes them in a new direction. So we looked at kind of his modified Flemish bonds and then created one with a kind of syncopated skip in it. And that's the brick bond that articulates much of the building. Terracotta was also part of the original campus. And originally, these were, you know, Beaux-Arts buildings, and the terracotta was used for soffits and ornamental kind of elements and fascias. You know, here we're using it in a contemporary rain screen. It's a Shildon, you know, panelized rain screen, but the kind of glazed white color is very much just a direct nod to the terracotta that's at the rotunda right at the base of the building. The west facade is a lot of glass, which, you know, is then passively shaded with a series of vertical sunshades. It also has a kind of custom frit pattern throughout it that really drives the heat gain way down as just a strategy, because we have a big west-facing glass facade to make sure it's, you know, we're managing that in a thoughtful and responsible kind of way. The roof is probably maybe unremarkable. It's a white, you know, we have a white membrane roof. It's a built up, the standard across that entire campus is a, you know, built up roof. And so, but with a white top sheet, but that's probably the most, you know, unremarkable thing. The whole building, whether it's the brick or the terracotta, is all done with the same idea of, you know, a continuous air vapor barrier that tracks the entire thing with all the insulation pulled to the outside. And that was a strategy partially because of the multiple use types within the building and knowing that we had different pressurization issues in different areas of the building. And we had different criteria that we were trying to meet in terms of air exchanges for different parts of the building. So we knew we wanted to give our engineers a good starting point to work from for that. I'm going to give a shout out to my colleague, Michael Henderson, who is one of our really great architects. And he came up with this idea when we were looking at the terracotta and we needed something that was very efficient and kind of, we could do one custom dye. We couldn't do as many, you know, a whole lot. And he had this thought that we should look at these kind of something that drew from the human body. And so he started mapping the kind of sinus wave of the human heartbeat, right? That this is something that they vary from person to person, but they uniformly have a similar form and a similar structure to them, right? And so could we take something like that and just put it in as a little kind of Easter egg in the project where, you know, it's in there. A few months ago, I was touring the building with some pre-med students, and I was telling that story, and they kind of looked very curiously at it, and they're like, well, Yeah. Okay. So I was like, okay, I think we passed their test. And so the intent was that it just speaks to this idea of that something that's inside of all of us, but then you take it and multiply it thousands of times and it becomes this very abstract kind of element of community, something that just expands across the entire facade.
Inside, the Grand Concourse creates a vertical linkage between interior spaces, and natural wormwood slats create a neutral palette that reflects daylight throughout.
This kind of Grand Concourse that links everything together is really, that's what welcomes you at both front doors. We linked it, you know, across all the terrain, and it links to a kind of elevator core that provides the accessibility, and then this kind of cascading stair that, you know, spatially links the two. That's all kind of behind that west glass facade. So it behaves very much like a porch, a kind of indoor-outdoor space that lets the light and the activity in, and at night is very activated by the, you know, everything that's going on inside of it. And you know, the wellness garden gave us the key to kind of get everything organized, and then we had to kind of stitch it all back together. And so this kind of large concourse, and I say large, but it's really, you know, it's not incredibly spacious. It links vertically in a kind of clever way that where it never turns into an atrium. It always is linking a couple spaces at a time, but creating this vertical movement through the site and up through the building. You know, it's a very simple palette. The whole interior is done with a very, very modest, simple, natural palette. That's just a lot of concrete floors, wood slats on the walls, lots of wood throughout just because of its natural kind of warmth and variegated life that it kind of brings into the interiors. You know, little pops of color kind of through the furniture, but that's really, you know, that's really about it. There's not, you know, the intent again was to create a little bit of a neutral, natural environment that fronts the people that are in it. And so it really, you know, the colors are in the seats and these kind of very, you know, comfortable tactile surfaces that are all the things that people touch throughout the space. One of the challenges that we brought to the table and the university signed on to, which we were thrilled about, was we did the entire interior red list free, because we just said, look, you're doing a wellness center. How do you not do that? You need to do that. And we maybe regretted it a few moments later, but we made it and we got it done. Just because there were some, you know, with all these program types, that gets a little challenging when we get into a health clinic or when we get into some of the athletic spaces. It presented some real challenges. The counseling suite is kind of a lovely space that is not part of the public realm, but is perched kind of at the highest point of the building. And the idea was they wanted as much daylight as possible, but they also need an incredible level of privacy. And so the way we thought to solve that is to use the section and to move them to the top where they could have very big windows that don't have to be covered because nobody can see in. And so, you know, there's some simple things there where, yes, it's still just an office, but it's got a really big window that, you know, makes it a really nice spot to be. Probably one of the most unique rooms in the whole building is actually the interfaith room, which was a really interesting challenge because the Carnegie Mellon, not uniquely, but very specifically, has a very large international population. And the range of faiths and groups on campus is incredible. And so we kind of were then tasked with how do we create a space that can serve them all individually, but then also be a space for them all to come together in an interfaith kind of, you know, environment. And so we developed this sort of perfectly circular room that's just wood walls with a little bit of indirect light, all indirect lighting from the top, and it can orient and reorient into, you know, a number of different configurations and operate in an axial manner or operate, you know, facing towards Mecca. And it, you know, it was really kind of an incredible challenge and one that was one of the real joys of the project to get to work with all these groups and kind of understand the similarities, quite honestly, between all of them.
Materials from the original gym, including wood flooring and copper panels, were reused throughout the project, giving the building a sense of continuity and connection to its history.
So we salvaged the element, you know, we kind of took the elements from it, and then we were not necessarily using them in their same manner. And I know there's probably some semantics around salvage versus repurpose. So in this instance, we likely were more repurposing, because what we ended up doing is taking a lot of the old gymnasium floor, the hardwood floor, and leaving it with all its marks, all its patina, all its, you know, all its history. And then we would reassemble it kind of into wall panels. So there's a big area of the main concourse where we've got it, you know, the whole surface is covered in, you know, these planks from the old gym with all their kind of bright colors and mismatched lines, and it becomes this kind of beautiful abstract that then also when people see it and alumni see it, they're like, I played on that. Like, I was there. And we ended up weaving that kind of throughout a whole series of the spaces. And that ties together kind of a lot of the athletic spaces and then their kind of office spaces and a lot of their student athlete spaces. The other element that we brought over is there was a series where we were connecting. There was a series of patina copper, which were these kind of pressed fascia panels from the original gym. And they're these kind of lovely chevron, just they had been repetitively kind of pressed copper that had been cut with then some flat copper behind it. And it had been sitting out, you know, it had been aging for 100 years. And so we just took those and formed them into the walls for the whole wellness suite and kind of did these lovely curved surfaces where we just brought all that copper inside, left all its patina, left all its time, and kind of made the entrance to the wellness suite with this material that we couldn't make today if you wanted to. So, and again, it ties again to the history, and we didn't use it as a fascia now. We bring it inside, we rearrange it into a new pattern, we give it a contemporary place, a contemporary look, but we kind of honor the time that took to turn it that beautiful patina.
The bridging concourse that unifies all of the different spaces presented the most prominent challenge to the design.
The connector, the concourse that really became the piece that had to do all the heavy lifting for the project, right? It had to create the address for all the different spaces, connect them, but keep them, some of them, separate enough. And then it had to, you know, bring people through a building that's, you know, essentially four levels on a site. You know, that vertical connectivity, and this is true, I think, of every campus building, right? We think, you start thinking about campus planning in a plan orientation, and it quickly has to become a sectional problem where we're working vertically. And so I think that was augmented by the kind of steep site and some of those constraints. But that really became, you know, getting that to do all that we needed it to do became, you know, something that was really critical to solving well. It also then was forming really one of the very public faces of this building, you know, into the campus. So it had the pressure from the outside as well as the inside.
Designed as a LEED Gold building, native landscaping and stormwater systems are integrated throughout the site, allowing the building to manage all of its water on site while responding to the surrounding terrain.
We worked with OJB on the landscape design for this, and they really embraced this challenge of how to really tackle all native plants, because that was that was something that the project always had as something it wanted to achieve. But then also a planting strategy that entirely was around this management of stormwater, so that pretty much every element, so there is no lawn, like there's a meadow on the south, but you know, it's a little counter a lot of university projects. We created a kind of permeable hardscape terrace to the south for students. So there is a place for the students to, you know, gather and sit and kind of be students. But then instead of creating the kind of broad lawns, and there's lovely lawns kind of nearby on other sites. So we used our site to manage all this water. That was really key. And then, you know, we created what I would just describe as a high performance envelope. We're doing the extra things in terms of the performative qualities of the envelope and the passive qualities in terms of managing heat gain, things like that. Energy-wise, it's a little tricky. We're on a district energy system. So you're not leveraging renewables, things like that. So the strategy then shifts to these other things. And then honestly, the indoor air and really focusing on the indoor quality became a real driver just because of what the building was. And because we, you know, said, look, let's commit to a building that is a really healthy place to be. Most of the spaces actually have operable windows, which is kind of a great element for a university building. And to have a client like that, you know, say, yeah, we'll let the building breathe when it needs to breathe. And, you know, there's not every space. There's some that have to be a little more managed, but, you know, we got a lot of it in there, which was great.
The historic structure presented several logistical challenges during construction, including working around the original rock ledge beneath the gym floor, carefully managing impacts to surrounding buildings, and coordinating efforts to allow ongoing programs to remain active throughout the process.
You do all their due diligence with the geotechnical and looking for that rock ledge and knowing its profile as well as you can hope to. And then inevitably, there's an outcropping that's not where you think it was. And thinking through how we could use that lowest level, because the lowest level is kind of at the sidewalk level, or originally was going to be closer to the sidewalk level at the north of the site. You know, as some of these things were developing, we actually manipulated and moved that lower level up, really only about a foot, but you know, it's a lot of square footage. And so it made some significant impacts to leave more of that rock where it was, because the rock wasn't where everyone said it was. So that's kind of an interesting challenge. You know, we were already anticipating a little bit of a kind of plaza in front at the campus entrance. And so, you know, we still have a kind of nice, gracious ramp up into it. And stepping up into a building or ramping up into a building in this setting is not necessarily a bad thing. So we really just, again, leaned into that and said, well, let's think about adjusting that. So that was one where that subsurface, you know, maybe wasn't going the way we wanted it. The other was the kind of the origin of that, what I was talking about earlier, when we dug into the side and actually then got this kind of beautiful profile of the ledge with the historic building sitting on it, which wasn't exactly what we expected. But, and then, you know, we got excited about it and said, oh, this would be kind of neat. We should leave it. And I fully expected everybody to walk in and say, why would we do that? We got to cover that up. Let's, you know, make it look finished. And it was actually the president of the university, to his credit, who stood there and said, that's incredibly cool. Let's do something with that. And so, you know, he was willing to sign on and say, no, this is part of our story. Let's do it. So we had it all came back to the site, right? And where we were with that. We had a great constructor partner for this who, the other interesting twist that this whole thing involved was we had the public park right to our side. And in the end, that park became the only staging area that was available because we're hemmed in on all the other sides. We have no space. No staging. We couldn't stage within the, you know, we staged part of the project from within the old gym and they used that for a portion of it. But, you know, we needed a good bit of outdoor staging as well. And so they actually worked out a great kind of barter with the city in terms of using a portion of the park and then doing some restorative work, sort of in exchange for use of some of the city land for a year. So that was, I think, a good, clever way, non-conventional way to solve some conventional problems.
We're going to build is right, or that we built is right next to a privately owned condo building that sits up and over the building. And, you know, we knew from the beginning that they were going to have concerns about the impacts of our building, not just for the building ultimately when the construction was completed, but also the activities and the impacts during construction, blocking there if we needed to redo their drive. We found out through the process a number of the utilities that served that condo building were actually on our property. And so we had to work with them for relocation of those. We specifically knowing at the very beginning, one of the ways we were able to kind of work with the neighbors early on was we said that we were not going to build any part of the building higher than the existing building, the previous building had been. And we actually, the part of the building that we retained a historic structure, that was the former gym that we renovated into the indoor practice facility. That building was the closest component of the previous building to these neighbors. And so we were able to, and we had anticipated this ahead of time, that we were going to say, look, we're not taking this building down that's immediately next to you, and we're not going to build anything higher than it. So they kind of knew from the very beginning what we were getting ourselves into. A second kind of aspect of that kind of known concerns that we had to deal with was where we were going to put our athletics folks that had been using the former building that we tore most of it down, where were we going to put them? And so there was a huge kind of swing process we had to do to find new homes for people who had offices like coaches and such, and find new performance playing spaces. Since we took the gym offline for 2.5 years, we had to work with our community partners here in Pittsburgh with University of Pittsburgh, Duquesne University, so that we could utilize some of their facilities over time so we could have our athletes kind of a place to play. Interestingly enough, that ended up being slightly less of a concern than we had expected it to be originally, because, of course, we were in the middle of a pandemic during some of the early days of construction. As we moved into construction fully in 2022, of course, and in 23, when we were kind of in the big swing of construction, we did have that issue. And that's when our partners in the region really came through and worked with us. And that's, you know, something that we had anticipated. So we'd been working on for quite some time ahead of time.
Kent relied on the advice of a mentor to help inform how to best approach this project.
For me, it was to embrace the complexity. And I was thinking about that relative to, I have a design mentor that I knew for years, the graphic and information designer, really, Joe Ballet, and he always focused on the term taming complexity, which I always admired, but I've now kind of, I think, maybe this project in particular, I think really led me to an understanding that trying to tame it all may not be the point. that embracing it, letting some of it, you know, still have some complexity to it maybe is okay. You know, because I think as all, you know, architects are trained to often look for simplicity or look for clarity or look for singularity. And I think a project like this really forced myself and our whole team, and there was a great team that I, you know, we worked with on this, that multiplicity had to be part of the solution, partially because you had things adjacent to each other that wanted to be together, but weren't necessarily going to function in the same manner and or needed very different criteria to do their jobs well, and that those two things could exist and coexist being as different as they were.
For Bob, one of the project's most compelling qualities is its ability to accommodate both public events and private wellness sessions, bringing mental and physical health into a single, thoughtfully balanced environment.
The way we overcame a building that in one way is one of our most public buildings. The performance gym will hold 1,000 spectators for a sporting event, or if you pull out the seats and put seats on the floor, can hold almost 1,900 people for a speaker series or something like that. So you have, it's a very public building and you need to be able to egress that many people out quickly. But at the same part, it is one of our most private buildings. And literally right on the other side of a wall is where our our psychological and counseling services are, where people are coming in for one-on-one sessions, or our health center right below it, where people coming in with, you know, health issues that need to talk to a doctor one-on-one, or maybe need an ambulance for service. So in a building that's, it's doing a lot of duty, a lot of hard work as it, as a building in multiple scenarios. So I'm very proud of that. I think the fun thing that we're super proud of is, you know, it was a historic building, or partially historic building, 100 plus year old building. We kept the historic part of it. And then we kept a lot of the pieces from the building, and our design team, especially led by Kent and through BCJ, integrated a lot of those functions into the building in kind of artistic ways. There was a series of copper pieces on the fascia board around the building that we took down. They reintegrated that as art in the building. I think the biggest, the funnest one is the old basketball court, which had been in the old gym, which is now a practice facility. We saved the floor and reintegrated the floor either in artistic ways throughout the building, but in cases of like the new varsity weight room, the old center court area with the tartan, the Scotty dog on it, was saved intact and hung up on the wall over that. Probably the best part about it is that the old seating area that says Carnegie Mellon, that for the basketball teams to sit on right there, we saved that and we put it right outside the entrance to the visiting team locker room so that they don't forget where they are.
The Highmark Center for Health, Wellness, and Athletics reflects the university's commitment to caring for the whole student body, while thoughtfully organizing a wide range of services that balance openness with privacy. Through its integration of old and new, as well as its careful attention to environment and experience, the Highmark Center establishes a thoughtful and supportive setting for student well-being. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. Drawing from NCARB's blog post, quote, "Insights from NCARB's 2026 Future Trends Report," I was interested in Kent's perspective on one of the highlighted themes, wellness, which posed the question, do architects have a responsibility to shape mental well-being through the built environment?
I think we absolutely have a responsibility to think about the people who we are making spaces for, and not just the physical part of the people that we're making spaces for. I think the semantic that I might address in their statement is influence. And I think the influence might be the piece that I might phrase differently, only in that I think, and this was a lesson learned from working with the doctors and the folks through this project, was really realizing that we're not there so much to tell people how to do something, but we need to meet them where they are. And especially when it comes to mental health, that sort of dictating is not necessarily the strategy. And that if we can realize that there is a very broad spectrum of people that we need to meet, and that then requires a variety of spaces. And so we actually tried to do a lot of that in that building, right? Like there's spaces that are bright and airy, there's spaces that are incredibly intimate and remote and very quiet. You know, we actually intentionally tried to create a very broad variety of characters of spaces, as well as postures of seating and everything else, so that people weren't being asked to kind of engage in any one way. They could engage in whatever way they felt at that time. And so I think that is incredibly important. And I do think that, yeah, we, you know, it's the same way that as designers, I think we have to think beyond what things look like and think about the other senses and, you know, what the space, much more about what it feels like than what it looks like.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Kent. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
Professionally, I bridge it because I've merged practice and teaching for so long, but what that has given me is just a chance to collaborate and work with so many amazing kind of young and emergent designers and thinkers. And so the thing that makes me kind of the most proud is watching, professionally, is watching those people find their voices, find their drive, find their vision to begin creating things that are beyond what I can do. And that always makes me happy, you know, just seeing that, because to be, you know, and I don't take sole responsibility in any way, but I like to have been at least some part of that. So just because I think seeing that, you know, I think, you know, design is this act of making things, right? And there's so much energy to pull things apart that, you know, the more we can collectively continue to, you know, making the places that are good places for people, you know, that's important. So that's why we show up every day.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.